We're going to go ahead and get started. First of all, the officer now here, cell phones, appreciate that. Welcome to all of you for coming out, making the time and effort to come here today. This is our first in-person luncheon that we've had in 2 years. So, we are so excited to see all of your colleagues and friends who we haven't seen in 2 years. It's amazing. This is a real thrill for us to have you all here with us. Either you were so ready to come out here or you really want to hear this program. Either one, either for whatever reason, we're really happy to have you all here. This will be, we spent like 2 years in disruption and challenges and changes and everything. And finally, we're coming out of COVID. And I know you've heard this all before in introductions, but this is such a this time of coming out of COVID is not going to be all that much easier for especially the benefits executives and people in the healthcare industry as it was during COVID itself. We're all still dealing with the disruptions and the adjustments and the changes that we're trying to adapt into the changes. And healthcare has become more important than ever, and employee benefits managers, executives, are busy trying to figure out how do we support our workforce, half remotely, half in person, in and out, stress and suffering from all kinds of issues that everybody in the world has been suffering from during the pandemic. So this is going to be a really interesting discussion, and I'm not going to steal time from all of our speakers, but I just wanted to let you know I think it's going to be well worth your time and effort to come here today. Because we're going to talk about market trends and healthcare challenges that are affecting our nation as a whole, it's also affecting the local community, and we have to have the healthcare leaders of the health plans, and also some benefits executives as part of this program today. So with just one other housekeeping point, the restrooms are outdoor and down the hall to the right, or the left. Anyway, that's the best one. And then we also are offering one credit for Sherman and one for AHRICI. So stop at your table to sign up for the credit or you need to if you want a single credit for each of those organizations. And so now I don't want to take any more time with the panel because this is a fireside chat. You see, we try to be a real flyer here. Well, no. So, okay, well let me introduce our panel and then we'll get started. So our moderator is Steve Heidler. He's the president and partner of Lockton Dunning Benefits, and he is our excellence at moderating. We're so happy when he's able to do this gig with us, being the president of Lockton Dunning. Also in health plans, so she works both sides, and she has an interesting perspective that she can bring, because again, she works both sides on the health system side and the health plan side, an integrated organization. So thank you, Jen, for joining us. And I'm thrilled to invite Lamont Thomas, a longtime friend and colleague. Get together once a year to discuss issues and trends and keeps me apprised of everything. Lamont is the market president of South Central CVS Health and Aetna. I'm not reading biographies to you because you have them on the seat, so I'll color code this there. I have your computer. Just your color microphone is what it is. Jim Springfield. If you'll come up, Jim is the president of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, and really appreciate your taking time to be part of this organization. That was my first time to meet Jim Simpson. So thank you. Marco, President of North Texas Health and Home for Cigna. Thank you, Keith, for joining us. Two of my favorite people, our board of directors, the Oswald Business Group Board of Directors, are two tight companies in this community. I'm so pleased to introduce Christine Albright. This is the senior manager of the strategy of American Airlines. Misty also serves as vice president of our board of directors. And then Eric Hoffman is the global benefits leader of the Texas Instruments. And Eric also is the chairman of our programs committee. So we have much to do with it.
Thank you, Mary Ann. It's like Eric drew the George call to start the next meeting. But it's nice to see everybody. It's been a long time since we've been together. And just to be together in this room and also just this panel, to have the leaders of health plans here locally, two plan sponsors, and the CFO of the health system. And really the third miracle was that I was able to fit in the suit today. I don't know what I'm talking about, suit, so I can barely breathe, but that's okay. So really, my role today is to really keep the spotlight on this panel, and these panelists as much as I can, and to really be a conductor, and in a way, a baker as well, really make it as conversational as we can. And if I need to take a pinch of money, you need to land the plane. Land the plane, make your point. So I'm going to do that, everybody. But what we want to go through first, really, is talk about, Jim, start with you. What opportunities do we see, as a health plan to partner with employers to really help them with in regards to steerage to the right providers at the right quality? How do you view that as a health plan?
Is this on? Okay. Thank you for the question. I think lots of needs, lots of changes that we're seeing in terms of opportunities around activation. Around providing information on those providers that are more efficient, more effective, higher quality, that kind of thing. Offering different products and services and integrating so-called solutions into our portfolios around navigation, telehealth, concierge, those types of things. Increasingly, we're seeing those requests coming from the big employers. I think our job, at least the way I see our job, is to be able to be sort of a master integrator of a lot of those services, where maybe historically we've been a little more focused on proprietary offerings and that kind of thing. But there are just so many offerings in the last, 4 or 5 years, we've seen $10 billion worth of investment in some of these promising companies. And they've been out actively selling the workplace. And I think that engaging them, getting them integrated wholesale with our platforms, I think is a good place to start. And providing the necessary information to make sure the quality is to run the job one. And frankly, that quality and cost aren't opposed to dynamics. They're very complementary. And I think that as we think about what we're doing, I think that's a pretty good place to start.
But CVS Aetna, it's a little bit different because you have bricks and mortar from a healthcare delivery perspective. How do you view, the way that you approach managing costs and experience, really just from a healthcare delivery as well with CVS Aetna?
So different models. Some employees, how do we engage the individual? How do we connect to that individual? So I would add to the answer to the question that you had asked is that we need to work with employers to figure out how do we make it matter to their employees and their families. Because at the end of the day, we can build all this, but if it doesn't matter what's in it for them, make it easier to connect to them, easier for them to access care, easier to the point of navigate. We built this long time ago thinking that we wanted to create a retail experience, and interesting enough, having CVS, we think that's what, but it's really about navigation. people are asking for help along this journey, and the healthcare journey. So how do we embed help through navigation? How do we get better information? How do we get data to the employer to make informed decisions? And how do we create a marketing program for the employees to understand that this is not a takeaway, this is not something that we're doing to shift costs. We really care about you're getting better. So what does that look like, feel like? This is not a takeaway from the network. It's really how do we expand the network and create a network that's centered around you. So I think that's the big difference, is a focus on centering our solutions and our and the plan around the individual.
Yeah, I think keeping things simple and individualizing it. And I think you're a good point too. So Scott, you know, you mentioned something, we talked about cost. So really when you think, how do you, when we think about cost, how do you define cost? But you know, how do you look at that? What, because they can mean different things, but how do you measure it as well?
Well, I think, you know, if you go back to your high school and even your college economics class, right, there are two things that go to the price, right? It's the unit cost and then the number of units that you use. And I think at the end of the day, what employers should be thinking about is, you know, how do I, number one, get the right price? It doesn't necessarily always mean the best price, but how do I get the right price? And then how do I partner with entities that can also help me control unit costs, right? And one of the things that I was going to, so I think that's how we look at cost as a whole. You know, one of the things that I think we need to be thinking about, and I'm going to go back to the question we asked Jim around high-performing networks, and I'll make it quick. One of the challenges we have, and one of the things employers should ask themselves is, what is a high-performing network? And then who should be using the high-performing networks? The arbitrary answer is everybody. But the reality is, you've got to look for alignment of your most chronic or sickest patients with the highest-performing providers, and that's where you get the biggest bang for your buck. And ironically, and I think you probably test this yet, that's what the providers are too, right? So when you get to value-based contracting, they can't do anything if a member only incurs $100 of claims annually, but they can help manage who incurs $10,000 annually, and that's I think where employers need to look is how do we get our most chronic, our most sick patients aligned with the best resources in the marketplace.
And you make a good point, Scott, and Jennifer, you know, with you, you know, Jennifer recently relocated to Dallas from Newport Beach, California. And I think what we've seen in California for a number of years is really how these high performance networks, these staffing models, really sort of better Scott and Wyatt in your chair as CFO, not only the system but the plan. How do you view high-performance networks when you negotiate with these reimbursements and different things with the health plans?
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in high-performing networks. Nobody wants a low-performing network, but in my experience, particularly from a capitated world, it's total cost of care, and unit cost matters, especially your fee-for-service backup. But total cost of care matters, and you need a high-performing network in order to go after, on a longitudinal basis, that total cost of care. At Baylor Scott & White, we are hyper-focused on access and navigation right now. I'm very optimistic about the role that navigation can play on smoothing over fragmentation member experience, and again, tackling total cost of care.
And I think, too, from an access perspective, so Keith, you know, how do you view the role of virtual care? Telemedicine, and how that can play when we think about access and all this stuff fits together.
Yeah, good question. By the way, I was going to wear a tie, but Stephen put it back. Honestly, I get it. There's a great theme kind of just going through all this conversation right now. And the one thing that I guess is the pandemic did kind of spike on something to all of us. I mean, we all were offering, telemedicine solutions for years and years and years. And for years, we've seen just marginal uptick on some of those things. So just kind of taking a look at it, the sort of the legacy telehealth kind of solutions and everything got a major push on it. Now I think probably the biggest kind of breakthrough would be kind of taking it even further than that and looking at virtual PCP kind of arrangements or PCP first kinds of arrangements. I think the physician community has actually responded very well. Really hands off to all of them. Most of them had some technology at their disposal, probably weren't leveraging it nearly as highly as we could have. And now, frankly, myself and others would probably prefer to enter the healthcare system that's you know, pretty fragmented, it's called what it is, in that way, a lot of the time. But I think that's, I think you're just going to see more and more of it. There's some numbers that we've seen just, you know, prior to the pandemic. You know, we were seeing, you know, 5-7% uptick on some of the utilization. Well, for urgent care, it, you know, it kind of bumps up to about 150%. And then when they do, they tend to stay in that kind of arena. So the satisfaction is really way off the charts as well. I mean, it's like 89%, 91%, same level. You know, for that, and then that particular thing to family, friends, coworkers, et cetera. So,
and I think that kind of leads to what I think from a plan sponsor perspective, with so many point solutions and different strategies, it's really having to put them all together. And because people, again, they want choice, but they want to be simple and to understand. Misty, so you implemented a navigation vendor a few years ago. Can you talk to just your experience with that and how you view it from a very honest perspective? It's such a diverse workforce spread all over the country. How do you view fitting your strategy and conducting that benefit strategy, connecting the dots?
Yeah, I think like everyone's talked about, you know, sometimes our team members just get confused about all the offerings that we put in front of them, which are great, but they don't know where to go when. And I think you'd be surprised, even in our environment, exceptionally human, high seniority, sometimes people just need a little help and want to be told what to do sometimes. And we found through our implementation of our navigator that we exceeded all benchmarks and our own expectations and participation. And so sometimes it's about just not doubting the help or advice that your team members want. In addition, we took it a step further. And I think, see, we were talking about is it the carrot or is it the stick, you know? And we've provided some opportunities with carrots through COEs this year. And again, voluntarily, our team members want quality health care and they want health care there. So I think, you know, navigation and an entry point single for a team member to help them with all of their issues versus having to talk to many people. It's gonna, you know, it really drives the care in the right place. And don't be scared of it. Don't be scared of it. I don't think your team members won't like it. I think if an 80% unionized company can do it, I think they can.
So in regards to navigation, maybe we can make this a little bit of a hot potato for the health plans. How do you view navigation, you know, one, the role that you play, but two, you do have offerings where you can fit with third-party communication solutions. So what are your views on just the navigation in general? What are you doing as a plan? How do you partner with third-party solutions? Maybe we can do general, start with you. You're welcome. We'll just go right down the road.
I think, you know, again, we've traditionally had our own sort of proprietary telephonic-based navigation, and you know, in all candor, that's a little bit discontinuous. And you know, everyone's working on digital platforms and apps and that kind of thing. And you know, I look out and say, you know, you can walk down the sidewalk, trip and fall, and find 10 navigation plans that are out there. And I think there's, I think it's a both deal. I think you've got to both create your own products and services, and I think you've got to learn how to integrate those that are already out there doing a good job. And if you're going to be responsive to what's going on, to in response to employers' needs and requests. And so I see it very much. You know, being able to focus on integration, not just development, seeing ourselves as a distributor of these types of services, not just a developer of those types of services. I think, you know, digital first is great. I think putting people in high performing networks is super. I couldn't agree more with the concept of, you know, price point's really important. If we look at these broker tools and I appreciate all that work and that gets done, but you know, your contractual price points are one thing, and that's a third of it, two-thirds of it's utilization. And how you navigate with the right person in the right spot, the right provider, the right time is more than just a political comment. And it matters how we seek pluralistically to allow that navigation to in fact occur. So I don't think it's as easy as saying, I'm gonna have this product you out of the box I'm gonna sell that one because that's really good, and we know we've got all the answers. I think there's lots of answers out there, and I think there's lots of good ideas, and I think there's lots of good companies. The question is, can we get those navigated integrated into a system that's rational, helpful, and affordable effectively at accomplishing that right place, right time, right cost, kind of objective?
Keith? I've got a kind of point of view on this, and it's, employers have kind of what we've kind of referred to as this, point solution fatigue or the abrasion that comes with every solution sounds amazing. And and quite honestly, there's about 4,500 unique solutions in the market today. And a lot of the consultants and a lot of the employer groups look back to us and say, what's the efficacy of this one or that one, and so on and so forth. And I spent quite a bit of my time in the past, really sitting down and asking, employer groups, what keeps them awake at night. Most of the time, if you ask that question, you're going to get a radically different answer than you anticipate. And it's by employer or employee, from employee to employer to employer. But quite honestly, to kind of interact back with the original question a little bit is, everybody kind of uses the web comment on data integration, this and that. It's really, what's the quality of the information, where is it coming from, and who can see it and use it. So I promised all of my associates I wouldn't turn it into a commercial, but the reality is that if somebody's calling from on a dental plan, and they've got, a pharmacy plan or a medical plan or something else, those people need to be able to see what's happening as well. And if that's the case, they need to be, forthright and really kind of step wing and help people get the things that they absolutely need to monitor and care about the health of the people, not just what's the enterprise of the thing that they want to consume. So, it's a great question, and it's a really, really complicated solution. But I think from employer to employer, you're going to get a different answer if you ask, what keeps them awake.
Yeah, I think only one point solution gets credit. Prostatomy, the ER visit. They don't get the credit for it. Lamont, how do you, because you have a different model as well, how do you view that with navigation, data integration, all those things?
Not so different in the fact that it's managing the data and following the ability to integrate. If you're talking to someone and addressing them in a holistic way as opposed to parsing them out to some other place or other solution that may be designed. So I would suggest as employers are looking at that, what's the best integrated approach that addresses that individual in a holistic way, whether that individual is suffering through a chronic condition or calling in because they need caregiver support or whatever the situation may be, you have a solution that can take that information, do something with it, not only with the information as far as getting direction, but more importantly, get that person to take action. Because at the end of the day, that's what you want, that person to take the next action in the process. And without doing that, none of these work, right? If you just say, okay, this is available, you can choose one of these doctors or this procedure, and they do something different. So it's all about how you get them to keep it simple and direct them to the right care that they take action.
And Scott, let me kind of change gears on you really quick. So when we kind of think about what we've really seen through COVID, and actually, Eric, let me give this to you. We've really seen this focus on mental health and identifying that. Can you talk about some of the ways that you're looking at that at the Texas Instruments to address that issue of mental health? One, to identify it, but also to maybe address how you might need a health plan or a provider to partner with you to provide access.
Yeah, so when you think about historically, the avenues that employers have given to their employees to seek mental health has been EAP. And that has been an offering that, quite frankly, is forgotten, along with a number of other things, which is only further complicated by the various point solutions because it becomes too complex. Becomes too complex to navigate. And ultimately, there becomes this perception of an underutilized benefit must not be removed. So specifically for us, we have a very rich EAP. But we've got to get people over the hump and make them feel comfortable with utilizing it. So part of what we are doing is educating managers on how to identify those needs to try to direct people to that. That's not going to be enough, but it's a start. That mental health in general just has to be a conversation that everyone in the room gets comfortable discussing. The other, what I'm hopeful is, you know, I have some concerns about the virtual visits, virtual health visits. It is convenient, but what are the ramifications to that 10, 15 years down the road? Do we create a consumer base that treats an immediate need and foregoes the treatment on some of those preventive needs because they don't like the inconvenience of what that requires? Mental health, I think, in that space is different. It has given people access to providers that they generally could not get into today unless they wanted to wait 2-3 months to see someone that actually takes insurance. You can find somebody that will see you, but you're going to have to pay out of pocket. So I am hopeful that the mental health space specifically will take advantage of the virtual visits. I think COVID certainly shined a light on it. That needs to extend past COVID. But again, that's not enough. It is, I think, primarily about continuing to have that conversation and taking away the stigma that is associated with feeling like we need behavioral health.
You make a good point, because a lot of those providers don't need to take or contract with insurance at all. Scott, what do you think about that, you know, as you go into, how does United Health view that to contract, for people to know where to go? Have you considered that?
Yes, it's not easy. There's all sorts of fragmentation as part of that. I think that what I would say, though, and this is going to, I think what you've asked everybody in the last 10 minutes or so is, to me, for employers, it's really about knowing your population. So if I show a hand, how many people have teenagers, right? So you can call them and they will not answer it, but you text them and they will respond within 30 seconds. And when I say know your employees, that's everybody's going to consume healthcare in a different way. There's going to be a population who use telemedicine and think that that's the greatest thing, and that's something you should avail. There's others who are going to want a navigator that kind of walks them through the system, and that's how you're going to avail. I think mental health and kind of the potential shortage, kind of the lack of providers in that space, is going to require some of the same type of thinking, which is things like group telephonic sessions. How do we get access to that? How do we diagnose those that are maybe even more severe and get them the right resources? But all of that's going to require that navigation model. Now, the one thing we didn't talk about is, you know, many employers here are very large, and that's great, but those smaller employers might not be able to afford some of the navigation solutions. So we don't have the luxury of not building those. We've got to kind of serve all of our populations. We have to build the solution for the 5-employee muffler shop as well as the 10,000, you know, employer unit. And that may involve working with other outside vendors, but I think at the end of the day, it's really about what the employee base is and how they consume healthcare, how they want to consume healthcare, because you're not going to change that. You're not going to get your kid using their phone. You're not going to get that millennial to do things that they don't want to do in a different way. Picking a PCP as an example, maybe something they say, heck no, I'm not doing that. So you've got to create solutions that meet the whole population.
I think too we forget that millennials were down in the 40s. Which is crazy, but so Jennifer, when you think of just as a health system, has Baylor's gotten my feeling, how do you feel mental health? One, because of your own workforce, you can imagine what they have to be in the front line of their dealing with that. But also too, just as from a community perspective, how does Baylor Scott and Wright view that to provide the access from the mental health side?
Well, it's certainly one of, if not the greatest community needs right now, I think they've met that, just to echo a lot of points. And maybe from a community provider care perspective, telehealth likely, I agree, Eric, with your sentiment, probably made the most progress during COVID in the mental health space. And so we're thinking about it in terms of how can technology better scale access to mental health care in the community. I think we're going to need to make different investments in the provider network as well. So, you know, I think in that space for our employees, and not too dissimilar to the community, although maybe sometimes a little more acute, particularly when we think about the long-term health and vitality of the workforce to continue to care for the community. more pandemics or not. So again, technology unlocking access, which is otherwise challenged outside of the cash market, I think is one. You know, virtual recruiting does other things again, just scaling scarce resources to meet a great need.
And Misty, so speaking of the front lines, I'm on the plane a lot, American flies actually a lot, but so I can only imagine with what you've got to deal as well with many of your flight attendants and other front line. Have you done anything different, or what have you gleaned from a strategic perspective from COVID around?
Yeah, so I think, you know, COVID gave us an opportunity to think about health in a general way, in a different way. And I think we focused a lot of times on mental health or medical benefits or financial health. And as a company now, we're trying to think about health in general. If you're not financially healthy, then your mental health is going to suffer, and possibly your physical health. And our team members through the pandemic, whether it was because of, you know, voluntary choices they made to take leave to help the airline survive, they were in financial situations, they've been obviously in mental situations, as you see it on the news, along with, you know, avoiding preventive care from that perspective. So we really are embarking on a journey from the very beginning of it, so please don't ask me to think about health in a different way, which health is everything that could interact your mental state, your physical state, your financial state, your family state.
And I think that's really how we define these has really changed. But what we would define as wellness 10 years ago is what you're really describing is really total well-being. And Eric, when you view that, you know, from a strategic perspective, have you taken that step of developing, you know, a total well-being strategy to Missy's point?
Yeah, I mean, we have what I would say is an evolution of just sort of a stereotypical wellness platform, which is focusing on, you know, less of the financial components. We do that, we tend to do that separately. So we tend to address things in silos. I think, quite frankly, it's difficult to connect all of those dots. And from an employer standpoint, you're also doing it with, you know, a blindness to some of the other information that would be necessary to truly paint a picture of someone's overall financial health. You also don't have necessarily visibility into what's going on in the household, some of those you know, social determinants of health. So I think this is a conversation that will continue to evolve. We've just got to figure out a way to talk about wellness and coach people in a way that does not seem intrusive. Because ultimately, when you start to connect those dots on physical health and financial health, I think that's going to make people uncomfortable. There is a way to do it. It's just you have to go about it in a thoughtful way. And I don't have a great answer to that, but I'm hoping you'll.
Yeah, Jim does. Jim, like, so kind of along those lines, something that's come out of COVID is really this need of health equity and these social determinants of health. And Blue Cross, you know, with all of you, you're having such wide networks and markets with rural areas, but also addressing even in urban areas that these care deserts. How are you looking at the data and viewing health equity, and how can you sponsor, you help them partner with them and sponsor, help them address that need?
Yeah, I think, you know, we think about things sort of basically in terms of hierarchy needs. We think about food insecurity, we think about housing insecurity, we think about economic security and jobs programs, and we think about, you know, we're evaluating a project right now in Southeast Texas around, you know, if we're going to have a service center in an area anyway, might it be smart to make those investments in traditionally underserved communities where people can live and they can work and they can stay in their community and not traverse out for those types of things, and it attracts other businesses and it attracts other jobs, and so if you're going to spend that money anyway, you should, the way we think about it, you might want to think about making that an investment as opposed to just an expense. I mean, you know, anybody can be in the Galleria, anybody can be in North Texas, anybody can be in Richardson where we are. But, you know, everybody doesn't go to this area or that area. And I think that doing that intentionally is, we've done it successfully in our Chicago operation, and really looking forward to doing some of the Southeast Texas here very soon. We think about, as we get into, you know, these things do get personal, they get in relative to individuals, and people do get uncomfortable. But, you know, there's sort of the community aspect of it, and then there's sort of the physical aspect when you start getting into in your Medicaid programs or your Medicare programs, and you start putting a dollar figure to making sure people have appropriate filters in their air conditioning units, and then their houses are outfitted with bars and that kind of thing, so they don't fall so they fall. And there's really good reasons to do that from an avoidance and spend perspective. And so you sort of have to look at those two different ways. There's sort of a community aspect about making an investment to help elevate people while you're also serving your corporate needs. And then there's the down to the individual level, how do you deal with helping your individual member, again, take care of issues around housing, issues around environment, et cetera, so that they can enjoy their life.
I mean, Keith, are you seeing the same thing? Are there pockets, you said Southeast Texas, Jim. If you can look at the data, is that consistent when we see these pockets or geographically it might need to be addressed? From the health
equity,
seeing those pockets in
the data? Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a really, really hard question to answer. Because quite frankly, but just looking at that Texas, there's 254 counties in this state, and there are a lot of those counties that don't even have a physician now, right? So, and I'm just talking about a primary physician, primary care physician.
You're saying there's not even a physician.
There are some counties that have way more cows than they do anybody else, right? Okay? So, and I'm not being flippant about it, but at the end of the day, it's a complicated equation to solve for. And most of the employers that we all serve, they're, anywhere from, depending on the size of that employer, anywhere from 20-25% of them are right here in Texas somewhere, and the rest of them are all over the United States. So, really the, trying to identify the areas that need the most help. And I could cite some examples, but they feel a little bit like age management does if you want to know the truth. The fact of the matter is if you see somebody that's taking an ambulance for some sort of a reason that feels a little routine, it's a pretty good chance that they're in a pretty significantly underserved area. But there are ways to address that. We do it's not blocking and tackling. Constantly looking at your provider contracts and the geography and making sure that your coverage is good. But it's a complicated one.
And I think you mentioned something, healthcare is a local thing. Every market's going to be different. And so, like Vermont, when you look at your career, you've been in Kansas City, Dallas, different parts. But how would you define the Dallas provider local personality versus other markets? That's me one more question. Sorry about that.
And honestly, when I look at it, I always hate when people say honestly, but I'm going to lie. But when you look at it, there is a genuine interest to do the right thing. Unfortunately, the way they're incentivized creates the wrong behaviors that we've seen as cost good. And when we look at more value-based arrangements, and looking at, even now, hospital systems that are talking about social determinants of health, incorporating notes like that in their medical records. So when people are coming to the ER, and they treat them, they want to know where are they sending them back to. So, and then reaching out and creating caring illness and folks that are out in the community, working with individuals and helping them. What I would say, I want to go back to the social determinants of health question because I think it's a very important question that doesn't sit at the laps of the health plans here, it sits along our laps. You folks have people that if we did a overlap of zip codes in this community, and then overlapped your employees, you find a lot of your employees live in those food deserts. So it's not a situation, not me. You look at your pay, some of your pay gets paid at the level that we've been talking about as a society that you need to get folks to that are in these communities. So I think there's a lot of work that collectively we can do. You look at virtual care. Well, that's how access is going to be gained initially for individuals to get care. So it's a new way to put that forth. So there's opportunities as stakeholders in this, healthcare providers, employers, city council members, health plans, we all gotta work together. You wanna work with folks that are involved in the community. So all of us do stuff in the community, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's working for solid food deserts. You gotta figure out how, as employers, you align with that in the community and really do this collectively. So if we continue to wait for one segment to solve for this, we're gonna be talking about this for the next 100 lunches.
That could be a topic by itself. It's not like with United, I mean, how are you partnering, you know, to address, it's such an important topic. It's blown on, thanks for bringing it back to this topic.
Yeah, so two things I'd say. One is, and I think we all kind of look at it this way, is when you look at the government programs, Medicare and Medicaid, I think that drives a lot of your decision making. So, you know, for us in markets where we're the Medicare, the regional Medicaid providers, I think that's where you see the biggest investment in some of the social determinants of health. But the one thing I'd throw out in addition to that, not that this isn't complicated enough, is, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, we had urban sprawl, right? Everybody was flocking to the cities. Now that we're moving virtual, there's a lot of experts that think we're going to see a rural sprawl, which is going to make this shortage of providers in the rural communities even worse. And so if you have people that are working virtually, the last, not many, many of them aren't going to want to stay in the Dallas proper area, the Houston proper area, they're going to want to go out in the country and where the quality of life is a little bit different. They have more land, they have more open space. What's going to happen with those folks? And it's already starting to happen where folks are using the virtual environment to go rural, and then that shortage of providers is going to be further exacerbated, as well as social determinants of health. So, not to bum everybody out on a Tuesday afternoon, but that's something that, you know, I think we should be thinking about, because that's a future state, and we can't get to 2025 and go, oh, now we've got a new issue, right? Which is we've got all these issues in these rural communities that are even more understaffed than the urban facilities. So we've got to be thinking about both of them at the same time. And I think, you know, organizations like ours and others that are there, the investment comes where you have kind of critical mass and membership, and you can make justification to do that.
And Jennifer, you know, within your chair, because the system of that's not fine, you spread down to Central Texas, through North Texas, but what surprised you? Did anything surprise you coming from California to that market to here?
The weather last night. certainly a lot more fee-for-service in this market, and so I do, even though I sit with a huge provider network behind me, I think it's an area of great opportunity looking forward, and if I could, I would like to connect payments to social determinants of health, because I think it's an important space. I think, in particular, the more we can seek to find interventions using that data to impact your trajectory of health and never possible care for it. But, you know, I think the economics are very different here in healthcare, and, you know, I'm certainly hopeful that's a place where, you know, we can help have some impact.
And your state income tax, which is
nice.
And Eric, you see, you know, this, like, you know, like, as you evolve strategy and think through, what have you done in regards to, you know, again, what you're hearing is just tying this stuff together. And again, keeping it simple, providing choice. How do you view that, where you think it goes with your strategy, where you take it next? That's probably a really hard question to answer. Well, you quick. Have you done things with navigation like Misty stuff?
So we have not. And part of our challenge is it has to be marketed in a way that doesn't make it look like restrictions. People, you know, I think Misty, to your point, people do want help. They just don't want to be told that they need it. And they don't want to be told or given the perception that the decision has been taken out of their hands. So you can do all of the right things and put all the right programs in place like a navigator. It's designed to steer you to better cost, better outcome provider. That doesn't necessarily resonate, though, with an individual member. So it has to be marketed and packaged in a way that is truly, you perceive it as what it truly is intended to be, which is help and not restrictive. What we struggle with is even knowing that you might be headed down the right path or a better path, is how do we position it in a way that it's going to be well received? It'll never be 100% well received. But, you know, and you think about even more basic decisions. If you have two different plans,
trying to get someone just to take the plan that makes more cost-effective sense for them is a challenge. It is a simple math problem, but most people, I don't know if it's a combination of, you know, there's an inability to do it. I think what it is, more so than anything, it's a comfort level. This is what I know, and this is what I'm comfortable with. And so overcoming that initial shock of a navigator or doing COEs or incentivizing in some way from a steerage standpoint, it, for us, we are trying to balance the, you know, that negative perception. And so I don't have a great answer for you. I think the other thing that scares, I think, us and probably other employers is it becomes one more item on the list of an ever-growing list that creates additional confusion. And so instead of going down a point solution path where we are trying to plug holes here and there, we've got to figure out a way to wrap our benefits. And this is where, you know, the health plans and the payers come into play, is that we've got to figure out a way to present this package in a digestible way. And where we are headed is it's becoming to a point where people just avoid the things that we're trying to get them to acknowledge. And so I think what you will see us do is not do the point solution items, try to pare it back and provide what is the most meaningful and not react necessarily to, you know, what's the market telling us that we need. That tends to be benefits. It's very reactive. You react to what is new and what people are hearing about. I don't think that's necessarily the best way to go about it. We have bigger problems that we need to try to solve, and we need to do it in the most simplistic way.
Yeah, to make a good point, because we're all living with the system that we all created. That's where we're at. So, Jim, you know, when we know, because we can't boil the ocean, we're not going to boil the ocean for the next 10 minutes, certainly. But what do you think, you know, what are the steps we start to do to change, to address it? Because Blue Cross has done a lot of different things from, I think you started to have, you know, your clinics, physician appointment, things like that. But where do you see, like, kind of the steps to transition where we kind of start?
Well, I think I agree that, you know, the concept of chasing new and shiny is, I joined Blue Cross in May, and there's plenty of new and shiny chasing going on out there. And I think that when we talk about integration, you know, I think about it this way. Integration is sort of making sure that things work well together. Everything tends to work well, you know, individually. You put them together and if it's not done properly, even well-operating parts give you a disaster result. And so I do think that there are there are big problems to deal with. I think, you know, provider integration, you know, so-called vertical integration, I think, frankly, makes a lot of sense in a lot of areas. I grew up in the provider side of the street, so I'm kind of accustomed to that type of model. I think that, you know, if you sit in a room like we are today and give everybody a mic and say, what do you think? Well, I think we should offer everything in the world that's out there. I like point solutions. I'm kind of a technical person. I want to do that. You've got others that say no. You know, that doesn't really make sense. I want to solve this. And the problem is, then if you want your employees, just like to go to ours, they're going to give you yet another combination of views that none of which congeal around a nice awful. It's not too different from the concept of individualized medicine and a conflict with sort of public health and how you deal with those issues as we've got to deal with in this pandemic. And so the truthful answer is there is no silver bullet again. And I think what we've got to work on is that we've got to pay attention to what the market's saying. We've got realities we've got to deal with. We've got knowledge and experience around what can work and what can't around some of these more public health issues, disparities, and that kind of thing. They're multifactorial. We've got to recognize people are scared, and it's the most intimate services, healthcare, and we gotta make sure we protect the relationships that are there. At the same time, we're doing that in a quality way, in a way that's affordable, because no one in this room, and I don't know if anyone thinks we pay, that we pay too little for healthcare. So if we all believe that, then change is an art. It's an art. And so I think the way we think about it is it's not a problem. We respect it for what it is. No easy solutions except for hard work, and you do it, one employer at a time, one partnership with a provider at a time, one partnership with one solution at a time, to try to meet those needs. And I wish it were simple, make it a lot easier, and we could be on about our day and all that kind of thing, but it's not. And
well, the good question is with quality, what was teaching you on? So, do you see the gatekeeper type models coming back into vogue? Like the, HMO is?
I see elements of that without the gatekeeper. I think we've learned from that didn't work for us. That it was the incentives weren't aligned correctly. But if you ask employers and you ask individuals what they want someone they can trust. They want someone that has a focus on the cost. So when they're directing me, they're directing me to the right setting, for the right price. They want someone that is incentivized from total health. And so when you think about that, that's your primary care physician. That's that model that we developed back then. And it worked, we can't call it HMO, right? Name. But it's really that model, that type of service, that type of trust that we're missing and think here. Is who's my trusted advisor? I mean, we talk about that as a health plan, wanting to be a trusted advisor. But at the end of the day, it really needs to be your physician. I mean, we've been taught that our religious advisors and our physicians are our most trusted individuals in our lives, but we need to create that environment. And I think when you talk about moving the direction of healthcare to do that, I think the folks that are employers in this room are the ones that have to step up. Because one of the things I hate is when they call us up there, the payers, you guys are payers. We just write checks out of the checkbook. You guys are payers, and you can be viewed as such when you sit at the table, not send us in there for you and the providers to figure this out, because we've been doing that. And we come back and like, nope, that's not where it itches. So we go back, we come back, no, that's not where it itches. You guys have to sit at the table and say, this is what we want, this is what we need, it hasn't been working, develop this. And we'll develop that together, and that's the focus. When they come to you, your employees, you can't just say, oh, the insurance company's doing that. It has to be your vision, your goal as an employer being executed with your partners. We have to change their mindset. When we do that, then the individuals start thinking differently about this, as opposed to, well, mom, the employer said this, and dad, the insurer guy said this, so I went to where I went to get what I want. We really have to design this for people, because it's too complex for the individual to do on their own.
And I think, too, it's not really a network when everybody's in it. I think when I started my career, it used to be a day when not everyone was in your network. Keith, do you see that, in the market where we get back to a day when you don't have, maybe both THR or Baylor, maybe the same network? I mean, there's so many different network varieties. Do you see the market moving that way?
Well, Baylor's got a mic sitting on the panel. Staying honest, I think you're seeing it already to some degree. It's kind of coming in a little bit of a softer form. You see, like some of the high performance networks that are in the market today, they all have a lot. There are certain inclusions, certain exclusions, and it has a lot to do with the contracting side of the family, where volumes kind of king in a healthcare buffet state. It's a complicated equation, but you're also seeing it in the form of customer-specific networks, things of that nature. Most of the time, those plans are offered alongside a broader type product, a price one that's a little higher. But if you're willing to maybe trade some access for a price point, it's certainly available in the market. A lot of these things can also be done on a client-specific specific basis. If you're large enough, if it's got more, maybe you've got some density, maybe the affordability factor can kind of come back into play. The thing that I kind of worry about a little bit, I'm just going to, you know, expose it, is when you do kind of tier a network or, you know, include or exclude something, you can actually create a little bit of harm in some of the underserved areas. So you got to be really super thoughtful about the way you go about those things. When the conference room door is shut and the CFOs walk in the door and they basically say, hey, I need for you to help me make this cost less, there are all kinds of little twists and turns that go with that question, you know, with that statement. So I think you're going to see it, but I think you're already seeing it in a very subtle way.
Yeah, to sort of degree the unintended consequence of doing something is what you're saying. And so I think, you know, what I'd like to do now is really open it up to the audience with questions, what you're hearing. And I think we're going to have a microphone go around for questions from the audience to really, you know, because we're coming up, you know, to 1:30. So turn over to y'all.
This question is for the insurance carrier providers. With the inflation happening at levels we haven't seen in 40 years, where do you see that starting to affect healthcare prices, what we're paying out of claims? And when we start seeing that increase, how long before we get to that peak? And maybe what kind of difference in our trend from what we used to.
Scott, would you have one?
No. I would say we're already starting to see it, right? I would say that there's not a day that goes by that we don't talk to a provider that we're hearing about increased labor costs, increased supply costs. You know, I think there's not a, when's it going to end? Who knows? But I think that at the end of the day, that it's going to be something we have to manage through with our provider partners and say, what is the right economic model for the employers that are out there? I see just real quick. I see the high performing networks in a little different light, maybe than some of those panels. You know, in any community you go to, there's a bell curve and there's quality and cost on the curve. And so there's low quality, low cost providers in any community. It doesn't matter what community you go to. And there's low quality, high cost providers. If you can just focus your population in the center of that, nobody has to take a cut in reimbursement. You get lower total care. Care with higher quality, and I think that's where we're going to have to go. We're going to have to look at those that have increased costs, increasing costs, and say where do they fit on that bell curve, and we're going to have to start gravitating towards the middle, and then feed data and give data to those that are on the outside of the bell curve to help them improve performance, because we do need all the providers in the community, but as an employer, what you need is the highest quality, lowest cost providers on a total cost of care basis, and that's where I think the desire for increases to cover inflation is where we're going to have to focus.
Hello, I'm Adrienne Rockwell from City Plano. I have a question for you regarding value-based contracts. I am personally of the opinion that they don't actually do anything. And I don't understand why we offer incentives to physicians to do their job. I know our philosophy at the city is that we expect everyone to do a good job, and we're gonna pay everyone, you know, a fair increase that's transparent. And if you don't do a good job, then we bend you out. So I feel like having these financial incentives that are tied to how many screenings are you doing, it just adds a lot of bureaucracy. I don't think that the physicians like it, and I struggle to see how this has improved our healthcare and if your costs over the years. Jennifer, what can this one do?
That's a good question. And I might ironically for a moment defend doctors. Usually I'm on the other side, not defending. So, you know, we all behave to how we're paid. I think it's just misguided to think that doctors are going to say, okay, I'm just going to make less money for the greater good of healthcare. I know that's not what you're saying. But I think it comes back to the payment model. Value-based care, as I'm learning a little bit more, so doing a bunch of hard work and keeping track of data and waiting 18 months to say good job or bad job and go back to pay people is likely a necessary step from fee-for-service, but I think it's fully satisfactory to move the needle all the way. I come from a market where there was capitation, and I think it just needs to be more real-time. And I think the heart of your question is that the payment system is wrong, because the outcome we're getting is perfectly designed to the way it's structured right now. So I'm a believer in capitation. I've seen it work. The payment model needs to change. Price transparency has to be there. Yes, the provider just said that, but I do believe it. But you know, we're getting what we've designed right now. The payment model has to change. I hope that speaks to it a bit.
Hi, I am Jen Treglin from Healthcare Blue Book, and my question is to any of you up there, employers or on the carrier side. With the evolution of the transparency laws, which that's a mouthful in and of itself, I want to know what your organization is doing to tackle those, and more than that, what you perceive the relevance or the impact is going to be to that end user, meaning the member, in the short term, I mean in the next few years.
What's that
one? I'm a big fan of transparency, and I don't want to, you know, throw any stones anywhere, but, you know, I came out of the provider side of the house, as I said, and, you know, what I'm seeing on the provider side relative to en masse, complying with the law that's out there is disappointing. You know, it's complicated. We've got a million permutations. You can't do this. Man, we underestimated this. It's just tough. And the whole issue is, we know what the issue is. You know, on our side of the street, well, we've got to provide machine-readable files. We're disclosing our rates. It's a public disclosure of rates. The spirit of the law, it's what's implied, it's what's necessary, and we just need to do that. And I hope, it's not unlike the stock market when it moved to NASDAQ and started clearing trades efficiently and electronically. What happened to spreads? They got smaller. What's going to happen in healthcare in an efficient market for prices? What's going to happen? Prices are going to go down. It's going to get efficient. Now, to answer your question about the member, I think the application to the member of these transparency laws is going to be, you add it all up, multiply by 10, it's going to equal zero. And I think that, but I'll tell you what's going to happen. There's going to be a cottage industry, I've already seen the data, where people know how to go mine this stuff, and they put it into a form, and they're going to sell it to employers, they're going to sell it to providers, and they're going to sell it to plans. And what's going to happen is, in my opinion, is that people are going to see that, and it's going to have a magical effect of moderating price. I need to get more, I need to pay you less, I can just hear the discussion. They're going to happen. So I think it's a big deal. I think it's being treated whimsically by the provider community right now. I think the fine structure that they've been asked to go up couldn't happen soon enough. I work for one of the organizations that said, frankly, I'll just pay my fine and that'll be better than disclosing my prices. I think that's a really bad thing. And you know, if it costs you $700, no big deal. If it costs you $70,000, it's a different issue. And I think transparency is a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's going to help the consumer initially. I think it's gonna get essentially disseminated through the provider and the plan ranks. I think it's gonna be powerful.
Jennifer, from the provider perspective.
Yeah, we have to talk about a touchy subject. So one, we're complying with the law. and you know, I actually believe in it. So I actually, as a CFO, I believe in price transfer. I think it's fundamental with what's wrong in healthcare. But consumers are going to be wholly unsatisfied with it, and consultants will get rich. Your point, I totally agree with you. That's what's going to happen with this law. Consumers will be unsatisfied, and consultants will get rich. But it is a start. It is a start. And until prices and the cost of consuming goods is transparent, we're not going to make any progress there. So.
A question also. Lamont, you mentioned when you were talking that it's important that everyone work on the solutions for this together. From the employers in the room, as well as maybe the broker consultants, what does that look like? I mean, how should we leave today and take action on some of the things that have been talked about?
I think the setting that you have is a good start with the Dallas Forward Business Group Window. You have all the folks at the table that are interested in participating because they show up to meetings or are part of committees. And then you just, as that group, and you've done this in other ways and other things that you've looked at and gone out to the healthcare providers and say, let's sit down and talk about this. Let's you talk to the payer, the payers, listen to me. And you've talked to the health plans and you said, give us some thoughts. What should we be looking at? So I think this is a good venue and a mechanism to do that. You just need to do more of it and start just bringing down the barriers, and let's talk about this, what's driving, let's talk about transparency. How do we make this more effective, work together to make it more effective to the consumer? Healthcare, as is mentioned, is delivered locally, so is change in healthcare done locally. We're gonna wait for DC to make it happen. You see what's happening from that standpoint. What tools do we have, what do we need, what information, and we drive that through a mechanism like the Dallas Forward Business Group.
Any other questions? Is anybody?
Hey. So I know we're talking about all disruptive thoughts. The most disruptive disruption that I've seen has been really around point solutions. I've worked in health systems for over 12 years, and then I have transferred into more of the point solution space, and I see lots of consolidations, lots of thought process around few things. And I think these are some of the questions that we need to be asking as employers, because I think you are the leaders that are driving all the changes. And quite frankly, this market is the employees that are dictating where you're going to be going. They are looking for the right benefits, right set of benefits. But the questions are these providers taking care of whole person care, meaning physical as well as mental health, right? Are they doing it in accessible manners, meaning omni-channel methods, right? Virtual care as well as in-person offices, but definitely driven by primary care. And I like what you said earlier about the gatekeeper model. The gatekeeper model is not gonna be here, right? Especially in Texas, that's not gonna work. But a primary care provider as a quarterback to care that really leads you to the right direction, but you've got to get to primary care provider, whether it's through the virtual means or through the offices, but that's going to matter. So I talked about the whole person care, but whole family care as well, because you've got people like me who have kids, so you've got to provide pediatric care in the same setting as adult care, and then I have parents who are going into the geriatric phase, right? So are you providing whole family care? But I think the question you hit on earlier is, are they providing whole community care? Because health equity is real. I work for a company based out of San Francisco right now, and health equity there, it is the status quo. It's not how are we providing health equity. That is how it should be provided, right? So the whole community care, whole person care, on whole family care. And I think every vendor you talk to or every health system you talk to should be thinking about those, or you should be pushing them towards that. And I think payers are your partners, consultants are your partners, but you are in the driver's seat driving these solutions, and you're providing care for your employees who are really truly in the driver's seat, right? So I just wanted to kind of make a comment on that, but you guys are all addressing the right issues here, and you are the leaders here.
Thank you. And again, it's great for everyone to be together. Let's give a round of applause for our panel. Now I'm just, to talk about when I get my car, so I can breathe. Great to see everybody. Thank you for your engagement and attention. That's again a wonderful panel. Thank you all so very much for doing this. Very much.
We did record this session, and so we'll do that and everything and make sure nothing was out there. You're responsible. And it will be available to those who attended today. Thank you all so very much for participating. This has been just a miracle for us to have such great, awesome leaders participate in this kind of discussion. Really, thank you.